I, too, had been a slaver. I had been sent on my first assignment as an EHM to enslave an entire nation. I convinced Indonesian officials to accept international loans. U.S. engineering firms received lucrative contracts to build projects. Our oil companies were granted concessions to drill wherever their seismologists thought petroleum might exist, regardless of the damage to the environment and local communities. Indonesia's debt transformed the country into a virtual U.S. colony and opened the door for apparel and footwear companies to exploit workers by turning them into the modern equivalent of slaves in sweatshops. After my success there, I repeated the process in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. The U.S. public was duped into believing that we were helping end poverty in all those countries. It worked so well in the Third World that we brought it home. The corporatocracy colonized its own people. It was the same approach, but it was applied to individuals instead of nations. Debt, privatization, deregulation. The corporatocracy knew that bringing us under their thumb always starts with us. If you manage to bury people beneath loans they cannot repay and keep them entertained with sports, American Idol, and the sex lives of celebrities, you can control their desires and financial decisions. You can manipulate and exploit them. Historians may well look back at September 11, 2001, as the threshold event that ultimately exposed the weaknesses of the system. It launched the United States into a war that severely strained the economy. Perhaps more important, 9/11 symbolized our vulnerability. The World Trade Towers, icons of U.S. globalization, collapsed in a matter of minutes. The Pentagon, the brain and nervous system of the U.S. military, was not defended. Most people have no idea how far we've fallen, a soldier who had just returned from Iraq with an amputated arm told me after I gave a keynote address at a Veterans for Peace National Convention in Seattle. I always thought of us as the good guys, until I saw what we were doing over there. We are Goliath, and now David has taken us down. Like Goliaths, empires eventually collapse. When they do, vacuums are created, wars erupt, a new empire emerges, usually no better and often worse than the former one. It is a pattern we do not wish to repeat. Instead of watching our giant society topple, let us transform it. As a student in Boston in the 1960s, I avoided walking beside the Charles River because it reeked so badly of pollution. A river in Ohio, the Cuyahoga, caught fire because of the pollutants in it from industrial mills and chemical plants. Since then, we as a nation have convinced corporations to clean up our waters. We have forced corporations to do away with ozone layer-destroying aerosol cans, banish DDT, open their doors wider to women and minorities, and stop supporting apartheid in South Africa. Recently, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, and other companies announced that they were removing trans fats from their foods after consumers demanded these changes. As a result, trans fats were banned in some states and included in labeling laws. Electric utility companies are scuttling plans to build coal-fired power plants and turning instead to wind and solar because government agencies and NGOs are refusing to allow them to obtain permits for CO2-emitting facilities, and their customers are insisting that they focus on sustainable forms of energy. All these actions, like the more historical ones, started with us, the people, and were directed primarily at corporations. And after the CEOs got the message, government officials followed. The resulting changes demonstrate that the marketplace is democratic, once we decide to see it as such. It is the ultimate polling booth. Corporations exist only because we vote for them in their stores, at the malls, and over the internet. It is up to us to decide which companies will succeed and which ones will fail. 150 years ago, we as a nation voted for Abraham Lincoln, and we fought a civil war in defense of our principles. Later, we picketed Woodrow Wilson over women's suffrage, and we held teach-ins for Richard Nixon to educate him and the country on the travesty that had become the Vietnam War. Today, we the people are called upon to speak again. When we impact bottom lines, we change stock prices and attract the attention of boards of directors. Those boards influence the decisions made in the halls of legislatures. We the consumers have won many battles over difficult issues. Voting in the marketplace is extremely effective. Now the time has arrived to ratchet it up a notch. Now is the time to win the war and transform our empire. Chapter 16. The Burden of Melting Glaciers. You know we must win the war on the mutant form of capitalism if you cross Karo La Pass high in the Tibetan Himalayas. At 16,000 feet, you look out across the barren landscape. You see the nomads tending their herd of yaks and the tiny black tents where they live, as they have since before the time of Christ. And you allow your eyes to move all the way up to the glacier that blankets the nearby peaks. This ice sheet, the locals tell you, almost touched the road less than two decades ago. A child could toss a stone and hit it. Since then, it has receded at an alarming rate. You shade your eyes, squinting into the glint of the sun reflected off the surface of a glacier that appears now to be at least a mile away. As I stood at the side of the road one afternoon, somewhat removed from the rest of the group of people I had brought to Tibet, staring at that glacier, I thought about the river systems that flow out of the Himalayas, the Ganges, Indus, Brahmaputra, Mekong, and Yangtze. They provide water to hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of people. The glaciers that serve as their wombs, their reservoirs, are disappearing rapidly. The people of India and China may have to wring water from stones, my Nepalese guide told me. Literally, I've heard that the Chinese are investing ways to convert a certain type of stone into water. He looked me in the eye and shrugged. I know, sounds impossible, and perhaps it is, but these rivers are about to dry up. And it's all because of us. Industrialization, global warming. He turned toward the glacier. We stood there in silence, and I thought about how the mutant virus has attacked this place. Deregulation has done far more than simply open the door for Wall Street abuses. It has meant that we in the first world have exported our pollution all over the planet. The glaciers are melting because we have allowed ourselves to burn more fossil fuels every year, despite overwhelming evidence that it is causing irreparable damage to the ice sheets of Antarctica, the jungles of Amazon, and the glaciers of the Himalayas. And we have sent our manufacturing processes to places like China, so we in the United States can breathe clean air while continuing to purchase cheap computers, tennis shoes, and appliances. A friend of mine came to mind that afternoon in Tibet, a man who runs a highly respected environmental nonprofit in the United States. He is an avid defender of birds, animals, and national parks, and a staunch supporter of laws that prohibit oil drilling off the California and Florida coasts. During a conversation, he pointed out that the amount of oil available from those offshore sources is minuscule compared to what we get from Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. He takes a hard stance against actions that might pollute our beaches or forests, and yet advocates drilling in foreign lands. The 30,000 Amazonians who watched their children die from toxic petroleum dumps and who filed the $27 billion lawsuit against Chevron Texaco in Ecuador are testaments to the short-sightedness of such thinking. Squinting through the sunlight at the Karo La Glacier and recalling my conversation with this man reminded me that throughout history, victory in battle has sometimes led to defeat in war. Bunker Hill is a prime example. Technically, the British won. However, they suffered terrible losses in terms of numbers of men and officers wounded and killed. At the same time, colonial forces learned that they had the courage and skills needed to keep on fighting. Winning environmental battles that protect U.S. beaches are ultimately self-defeating if they end up devastating rainforests in other countries. As much as we may detest the idea of oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, we also need to understand that seeing them from Florida's shores might convince residents of the need to conserve energy and shift to renewable sources rather than continuing their present rate of petroleum consumption. Viewing pollution in the Himalayas or Amazon as somehow different from that in the United States is provincial and misguided. The fact is, we are engaged in a war of survival. The only way to win it will be to focus on the global problem. The Chinese, Indonesians, Kuwaitis, and Venezuelans are not the enemy. Those who try to convince us to stay the course, keep on consuming, find new resources and lands and people to exploit, and worry only about protecting our own backyards are the enemy. By concurring, we become their accomplices. We too become the enemy. The guide looked back at me. I'm afraid my people in Nepal, these Bedouin here, and yours in the United States share a lot in common. For the first time ever, we all share a lot in common. We are confronting the same crises. Everyone on our planet is, every life form. We are all affected one way or another by global warming, economic collapse, overpopulation, violence resulting from poverty and desperation, species extinctions, increased prices for fuels, food, and other commodities, diminishing resources, and relentless pollution of the air, land, and water. I think about this whenever I hold my grandson in my arms. Because we are so closely linked, no child, including ones born in the United States, can hope to grow up in a sustainable, just, and peaceful world unless every child in every country has that same expectation. If the rivers of China and India dry up, the calamity will be devastating for every baby on this planet. And for the first time in history, we are all communicating with one another. Satellite phones and the internet reach into the deserts of Saudi Arabia and the forests of Siberia. We understand that we are under attack. The mutant virus of capitalism has infected all of us. If we are serious about loving and caring for our children, we have no choice but to set up rules and regulations that prevent us from engaging in activities that melt the glaciers, pollute the oceans, and fill the air with toxins. Ignoring the costs to the environment of the goods we manufacture and consume is like offloading an enormous debt from a company's balance sheet, assigning it to some fictitious overseas entity, and claiming the company's finances are healthy. It did not work, ultimately, for Enron, and it will not work for the rest of us or for Mother Nature. We have but one planet. It is our home. All of it. Chapter 17. Terror and Other Isms. Navy SEAL snipers rescued an American cargo ship captain unharmed and killed three Somali pirates in a daring operation in the Indian Ocean on Sunday, ending a five-day standoff between United States naval forces and a small band of brigands in a covered orange lifeboat off the Horn of Africa. The New York Times published that article in April 2009. The very words pirates, daring operation, standoff, and brigands were typical of the U.S. media. They made it sound as though white-hatted cowboys had ridden to the rescue of a town besieged by Billy the Kid and his gang. Having lived in that part of the world as an EHM, I knew there was another side to what had happened. I wondered why no one was asking about the causes of piracy. I recalled my visits with the Bugi people when I was sent to the Indonesian island of Sulawesi in the early 1970s. The Bugis had been infamous pirates since the time of the East India Companies in the 1600s and 1700s. Their ferocity inspired returning European sailors to discipline their disobedient children with threats that the boogeyman will get you. In the 1970s, we feared that they would attack our oil tankers as they passed through the vital Strait of Malacca. I sat with one of their elders on the Sulawesi shore one afternoon. We watched his people build a sailing galleon known as a prahu, much as they had for centuries. Like a gigantic beached whale, it was high and dry, propped upright by rows of gnarled stakes that resembled roots sprouting from its hull. Dozens of men hustled about it, working with adzes, hatchets, and hand drills. I expressed the concerns of my government to him, intimating that we would retaliate if the oil lanes were threatened. The old man glared at me. "We were not pirates in the old days," he said, his bushy white hair bobbing indignantly. "We only fought to defend our lands against Europeans who came to steal our spices. If we attack your ships today, it is because they take the trade away from us. Your stink ships foul our waters with oil, destroying our fish and starving our children." Then he shrugged. "Now we're at a loss." His smile was disarming. "How can a handful of people in wooden sailing ships fight off America's submarines, airplanes, bombs, and missiles?" The New York Times article was followed a few days after the Navy SEALs' rescue by an editorial entitled "Fighting Piracy in Somalia" that concluded, "Yet left to its own devices, Somalia can only become more noxious, spreading violence to its East African neighbors, breeding more extremism and making shipping through the Gulf of Aden even more dangerous and costly. Various approaches are being discussed, such as working through Somalia's powerful clans to reconstitute first local and then regional and national institutions. These must be urgently explored." Nowhere did the New York Times or any of the other media outlets that I read, heard, or saw attempt to analyze the roots of the problem in Somalia. Debates abounded about whether to arm ships' crews and send more Navy vessels to the region. There was that vague reference to reconstituting regional and national institutions, but what exactly did the author mean by that? Institutions that would truly help, like free hospitals, schools, and soup kitchens? Or local militias, prisons, and Gestapo-style police forces? The pirates were fishermen whose livelihoods had been destroyed. They were fathers whose children were hungry. Ending piracy would require helping them live sustainable, dignified lives. Could journalists not understand this? Had none of them visited the slums of Mogadishu? Finally, NPR's Morning Edition on May 6th aired a report from Gwen Tompkins. She interviewed a pirate who went by the name Abshir Abdullahi Abdi. "We understand what we're doing is wrong," Abdi explained, "but hunger is more important than any other thing." Tompkins commented, "Fishing villages in the area have been devastated by illegal trawlers and waste dumping from industrialized nations. Coral reefs are reportedly dead. Lobster and tuna have vanished. Malnutrition is high." You might think we would have learned from Vietnam, Iraq, the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia back in 1993, and other such forays, that military responses seldom discourage insurgencies. In fact, they often do the opposite. Foreign intervention is likely to infuriate local populations, motivate them to support the rebels, and result in an escalation of resistance activities. That was the way it happened during the American Revolution, Latin America's war for independence from Spain, in colonial Africa, Indochina, Soviet-occupied Afghanistan, and so many other places. Blaming pirates and other desperate people for our problems is a distraction we cannot afford if we truly want to find a solution to the crises confronting us. These incidents are symptoms of our failed economic model. They are, to our society, the equivalent of a heart attack to an individual. We send in Navy SEALs to rescue the hostages, as we would hire doctors to perform a coronary artery bypass. But it is essential to admit that both are reactions to an underlying problem. The patient needs to address the reasons his or her heart failed in the first place, such as smoking, diet, and lack of exercise. The same is true for piracy and all forms of terrorism. Our children's futures are interlocked with the futures of children born in the fishing villages of Somalia, the mountains of Burma, Myanmar, and the jungles of Colombia. When we forget that fact, when we see those children as remote, as somehow disconnected from our lives, as merely the offspring of pirates, guerrillas, or drug runners, we point the gun at our own progeny as well as at the desperate fathers and mothers in lands that seem so far away, but in reality are our next-door neighbors. Every time I read about the actions we take to protect ourselves from so-called terrorists, I have to wonder at the narrow-mindedness of our strategy. Although I have met such people in Bolivia, Ecuador, Egypt, Guatemala, Indonesia, Iran, and Nicaragua, I have never met one who wanted to take up a gun. I know there are crazed men and women who kill because they cannot stop themselves, serial killers and mass murderers. I am certain that members of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and other such groups are driven by fanaticism. But such extremists are able to recruit sizable numbers of followers only from populations that feel oppressed or destitute. The terrorists I have found in Andean caves and desert villages are people whose families were forced off their farms by oil companies, hydroelectric dams, or free trade agreements. Their children are starving, and they want nothing more than to return to their families with food, seeds, and deeds to land they can cultivate. In Mexico, many of the guerrillas and narco-traffickers once owned farms where they grew corn. They lost their livelihoods when the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, gave subsidized U.S. producers an unfair price advantage. Here is how the Organic Consumers Organization, a nonprofit that represents more than 850,000 members, subscribers, and volunteers, describes it. Since NAFTA came into effect on January 1, 1994, U.S. corn exports to Mexico have almost doubled to some 6 million metric tons in 2002. NAFTA eliminated quotas limiting corn imports, but allowed U.S. subsidy programs to remain in place, promoting dumping of corn into Mexico by U.S. agribusiness at below the cost of production. The price paid to farmers in Mexico for corn fell by over 70%. The passage above exposes the dark side of free trade policies. U.S. presidents and our Congress have implemented regulations that prohibited other countries from imposing tariffs on U.S. goods or subsidizing locally grown produce that might compete with our agribusinesses while permitting us to maintain our own import barriers and subsidies, thus giving U.S. corporations an unfair advantage. Free trade is a euphemism. It prohibits others from enjoying the benefits offered to the multinationals. It does not, however, regulate against the pollution that is melting glaciers, the land grabs, and the sweatshops. The Nicaraguan priest, who administered to Sandinista guerrillas and was now president of the UN General Assembly, has a first-hand appreciation for such euphemisms and the power of words used to sway public perceptions. Terrorism is not really an ism, Father Miguel Descoto told me. There's no connection between the Sandinistas who fought the Contras and Al-Qaeda, or Colombia's FARC and fishermen-turned-pirates in Africa and Asia. Yet they are all called terrorists. That's just a convenient way for your government to convince the world that there is another enemy-ism out there, like communism used to be. It diverts attention from the very real problems. Our narrow-minded attitudes and the resultant policies foment violence, rebellions, and wars. In the long run, almost no one benefits from attacking the people we label as terrorists, with one glaring exception: the corporatocracy. Those who own and run the companies that build ships, missiles, and armored vehicles, make guns, uniforms, and bulletproof vests, distribute food, soft drinks, and ammunition, provide insurance, medicines, and toilet paper, construct ports, airstrips, and housing, and reconstruct devastated villages, factories, schools, and hospitals, they, and only they, are the big winners. The rest of us are hoodwinked by that one loaded word, terrorist. The current economic collapse has awakened us to the importance of regulating and reining in the people who control the businesses that benefit from the misuse of words like terrorism and who perpetrate other scams. We recognize today that white-collar executives are not a special incorruptible breed. Like the rest of us, they require rules. Yet it is not enough for us to re-establish regulations that separate investment banks from commercial banks and insurance companies, reinstate anti-usury laws, and impose guidelines to ensure that consumers are not burdened by credit they cannot afford. We cannot simply return to solutions that worked before. Only by adopting new strategies that promote global environmental and social responsibility will we safeguard the future. One of the world's great spiritual leaders, the Dalai Lama, clearly understands and promotes this. He expressed his version of a call for action one morning when I sat beside him on an airplane flying over the Himalayas. Chapter 18. The Dalai Lama. Prayer and Action. Our group arrived very early at the airport in Leh, Ladakh. As we sat waiting for our flight to India to be announced, the Dalai Lama and his entourage swept into the tiny lobby. We had heard him speak to a crowd of thousands of Tibetans several days earlier, but had been unable to arrange a private meeting with him. One of our group excitedly told me that the Dalai Lama was carrying my book, Shapeshifting. Someone else informed his secretary that the author of that book was on his flight. When we boarded, I was immediately ushered to the front of the Boeing 737. The Dalai Lama smiled up at me and patted the seat beside him. "Wonderful," he said as he tapped the cover of Shapeshifting. "I'd like to learn more." The plane took off. He pointed down at the Himalayas and named several of the Buddhist monasteries I had visited. Then he and I chatted about indigenous people and their commitments to living sustainable lives. I explained that the reason the Shuar in the Amazon go to war and shrink enemy heads is because one of their gods commanded that if their populations get out of control, you must weed your own garden. That god was angry at the Shuar because their growing numbers were causing the extinction of other species, both plants and animals. The Dalai Lama nodded and then was silent for a moment. When he spoke, he admitted that while he did not condone violence, he could understand that god's point. "Peace is possible," he said, "only when we humans show compassion for all sentient beings. We must take responsibility for protecting life." He said that it was important that we act in responsible ways, not just think, talk, and pray about it. I mentioned that a famous writer from the West had recently called on everyone to stop what they were doing on a specific day at a certain time and pray for peace. "Prayer is very good," he responded, "like meditation, but not enough." He went on to express concern that if millions of people across the planet prayed for peace and then ended by feeling they had done their jobs, believing that the prayers were all that was necessary, we would probably never have peace. "We need to take action." He broke into that smile of his I had seen on the covers of his books. "Yes, we must act." At the end of the flight, the Dalai Lama invited our group to his home in Dharamsala, India. A couple of days later, we spent the better part of an afternoon chatting with him there. It was a deeply moving and inspiring exchange that encompassed a wide range of topics. Yet the thing that impressed me most was his emphasis on taking action. Here was one of the world's great spiritual leaders stressing the importance not of prayer or meditation, but of concrete action. Later, when our group assembled back at the hotel, one of the women pointed out that Christ, Confucius, Muhammad, Buddha, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Nelson Mandela had made similar statements. Action is essential, a neuroscientist friend told me after I returned home and related my discussion with the Dalai Lama to him. But it's important to recognize that there are a couple of steps that precede the action. This is where the prayer that writer was promoting for peace comes into play, or the Dalai Lama's meditation, or what your indigenous friends might refer to as the dream. He pointed at a glass of water on the table between us. Before I can pick up that glass, I have to be motivated. Thirst. Sure, or maybe I want to clear the table, he grinned. Or throw the water at you. It doesn't really matter. The thing is, I have to be motivated. Then I have to believe I can do it. I have to dream of doing it. My brain has to send signals to my arm and hand that I want and am able to pick up that glass. He peered at me. There are hundreds of people relegated to mental institutions because their minds can't send out those kinds of signals. He bent forward and reached for the glass. After I've done all that, then I can swing into action. He picked it up, raised it to his lips, and stopped. Now, an impish smile, I have to decide, do I drink or throw it at you? Collectively, we are staring at that glass. Decision time is here. What shall we do with it? In the historic perspective of economic development, our species has progressed from infancy to adolescence. Metaphorically, as hunters and gatherers, we crawled on the earth. After a while, we straightened, wielded the hoe, and became cultivators. Rather than accepting that we could receive only things that were offered by nature, we took steps to gain more control. We planted and harvested, studied weather patterns and crop cycles, domesticated animals, and learned to create fabrics and weave cloth. We hammered out tools and weapons. Then, perhaps beginning with small nomadic bands sweeping down from the Asian steppes into the more fertile regions of the Middle East and Europe, we plundered. We grew enamored with the possibilities of exploiting others. We became competitive and aggressive. We organized ourselves into societies whose goals were to outcompete their neighbors. We bought into the idea that resources are finite, that in order for our people to have more, we have to take from someone else. Previous chapters of this book have followed our economic revolution from mercantilism to industrialization, and to this time when competition is seen as revolving around finance, communications, and computer technologies, and when nations have been replaced by multinational corporations as the driving forces behind geopolitics. Now, in the face of the worldwide recession, we sense a frustration around our accomplishments. We confront the knowledge that we are self-destructing. The crises symbolized by melting glaciers are beginning to convince us that it is time to move beyond the old principles that have guided us through the past centuries, to push ourselves along the economic development curve, to abandon that exploitative, colonialist, adolescent attitude and embrace a mature recognition that we are a fragile species living on a very tiny planet. The hour has arrived for us to understand that my grandson cannot live a satisfying life unless all his brothers and sisters around the world also live satisfying lives. Homeland security will become a reality only when we accept the entire planet as our homeland. It is time for us to act as though we are all in this together, and our very existence depends on cooperation, because both those things are true. We have arrived at the point where we know we must insist that our business and political leaders guide us along a path to a future that leads to long-term sustainability, justice, and peace for all people. We know, too, that it is up to us to insist that they do this. Our leaders must be pushed. Past empires expanded through military conquests. This has changed. The current forces controlling the world were not built by armies, but through corporations. We need to act, but we do not need to take up arms to transform them. The next chapters present a strategy for implementing change that encompasses five arenas of action. 1. Accepting consumer responsibility. 2. Creating a new economy. 3. Adopting attitudes that encourage good stewardship and make icons of a new type of hero. 4. Implementing new rules for business and government. 5. Honoring our individual passions. If relatively few of us, a critical mass, a tiny percentage of the population, consciously takes action in each of these arenas, we will succeed in our lifetime. Chapter 19. Accepting Consumer Responsibility. Refuse to purchase another Nike product, a woman at one of my talks said as she stood and waved her hands over the audience, and send an email to Nike explaining that you won't buy anything from them until they stop using sweatshops. Instead, buy from one of the sweat-free companies. They are on the internet, and send them an email telling them it's because they don't use sweatshops. If enough of us do that, Nike will have to change or go out of business. What happens to all the Indonesians who worked in those sweatshops? A man across the room shouted. I stepped to the microphone. No one needs to lose a job, I said. The goal is to convince companies like Nike that they must turn sweatshops into legitimate factories where the workers get wages that allow them to live decent lives, including the ability to pay for health care and retirement. Another woman raised her hand. Are you telling me, she asked, that I have to spend more for my kids' shirts and tennis shoes so I can support some family in Asia? I already work two jobs and can hardly make ends meet. I answered by relating a story about my daughter Jessica. She called one day back when she was pregnant. She had been shopping for cribs online. I found one, she said, for $200. It's made in China, probably at a sweatshop. There's another that's manufactured in a non-sweatshop Canadian factory and constructed from woods that are certified not to come from old-growth or rainforest trees. It costs $600. What do you think, Dad? I looked out over the assembled people and told them that Jessica worked for a non-profit organization. She did not make much money and was very careful about how she spent every penny. Of course, I'll pay the extra $400, she continued over the phone. I'd somehow scrape together $400 for a car seat to protect my baby's life, or a daycare center that I know is safe, so why not do it to create a world that will be just and safe? It's an investment in his future, not a sacrifice. I told that audience, as I have many others, that paying more for products made by companies that are socially and environmentally responsible is always an investment in the future. It means we are not passing that debt onto our children. Sometimes, I say, you may not be able to afford the investment. You may have to purchase the cheaper item. If that happens, at least be conscious that you're foregoing an investment. Beyond that, though, make a commitment to yourself that when you can afford it, you will do the smart thing, the thing that is best for you and your children over the long term. As consumers, we have tremendous power. This book has emphasized that the marketplace is a democratic voting booth. We, the people, can decide to use our purchasing leverage to encourage good stewardship. When we stopped purchasing gas-guzzling SUVs during periods of escalating oil prices, auto manufacturers closed factories. The same thing occurred with children's toys from China after we learned they contained carcinogens, with cigarettes following campaigns that exposed the health problems they posed to children who breathed secondary smoke, with asbestos in building materials, and with many other products. Some management theorists speculate that one reason CEOs of big corporations are paid so much money is that they are among a rare few who have the proper skills and that they also lack the type of consciences that prohibit most of us from selling products and making decisions that destroy lives. Tom Hartman writes, "Only about 1 to 3% of us are sociopaths, and of that 1%, there's probably only a fraction of a percent with a college education, an even tinier fraction that understands how business works. Thus, there is such a shortage of people who can run modern monopolistic, destructive corporations that stockholders have to pay millions of dollars to get them to work. And being sociopaths, they gladly take the money without any thought of its social consequences." Perhaps sociopaths do indeed sit at the top of some of our largest corporations, but that should not deter us. They depend on us to buy their goods and services. They do not command militaries that force us to purchase their products. Most of the executives I know, including ones I met during my EHM years, are not sociopaths. Rather, they are infected by this same mutant form of capitalism. They are driven by the belief that their job is to make profits, period. When offered the opportunity, they hurry to attend corporate social responsibility, CSR, conferences. They embrace the idea of the triple bottom line. Once we empower them to consider goals other than profit, they act with enthusiasm. A Portland, Oregon radio host recently asked me, "If you could give one piece of advice to Phil Knight, Nike founder and chairman of the board, what would it be?" "I'd suggest," I answered, "that he follow Henry Ford's example. Ford said he wanted to pay his workers enough so they could buy a Ford. If Nike did the same, wherever it has sweatshops, this would be a much safer and better world, and Nike's sales would skyrocket." On the air, we discussed the fact that Nike has taken steps to become more environmentally responsible and has invested a great deal of money into public relations efforts to convince us that its workers are better off today than they were a few years ago. However, Jim Keady and Leslie Kretzu, the co-founders of Educating for Justice, described in Chapter 4, along with other NGOs that monitor the situation in Indonesia and elsewhere, have found that the people who produce Nike products in many of these countries are still terribly underpaid and work in abysmal conditions. I do not know Phil Knight or his psychological profile. It is possible that he is one of those sociopaths. If so, he is not likely to subscribe to Ford's philosophy. However, we the consumers, you and I, can force him to treat his workers humanely. We simply stop buying Nike products until the company changes its policies. I told that radio audience in Portland, "I would like nothing better than to wear the Nike swoosh as a symbol of a company that is doing everything possible to make this a better world. That time will come if we all refuse to wear the swoosh until Nike makes a commitment to take care of the people who produce its products." Two other questions are regularly asked during the Q&A periods after my talks. 1. What about corporations that supply the military? How do we turn them around? 2. How can I judge a corporation's commitment to behaving in socially and environmentally responsible ways? The short answer to the first question is that we have more influence over the military-oriented businesses than we may think. Organizations like Rainforest Action Network, RAN, have found that corporations that are not retailers, like Boise Cascade and most military suppliers, or ones that are in businesses where they do not believe the consumer develops any particular product loyalty, like Citigroup and military suppliers, have their own sets of leverage points. You request the help of their biggest buyers, Mike Broon, RAN's executive director, told me one day as we sat in a San Francisco restaurant. When Boise Cascade refused to negotiate, we enlisted Kinko's and some of Boise's other customers who had already signed on to our program. The pressure worked. With the big banks, you may have to embarrass their top executives. RAN has published photos of corporate presidents in newspaper ads with captions about destroying forests and murdering indigenous people, and it has dispatched members armed with placards and banners to speeches given by corporate officials. an approach similar to that used by the women's suffrage movement against Woodrow Wilson. Both approaches brought results. Corporate executives, Mike continued, are people. They have to face their children. They respond to social pressures just like you and me. A longer answer to this question about influencing the military-industrial complex has to do with changing the economy. It is addressed in the next chapters. The second question, often asked, is about assessing a corporation's commitment. As Jessica found when looking for my grandson's crib, a great deal of information is available over the Internet. While sources are not always accurate, they are constantly updated and improvements are made on an almost daily basis. Google and other search engines are good resources for making sure that we obtain the most current data. At the time of this writing, one helpful source was the website of the nonprofit Green America, formerly Co-op America. For example, based on their research, if you wanted to know about tennis shoes, here's what Co-op America said in April 2009. Sneakers, leaders, and laggards. Footwear can be one of the trickiest parts of building a sweatshop-free wardrobe. Hundreds of shoe companies have shifted their operations overseas in recent years, and many have little or no oversight for their supply chains. We use two of Co-op America's online tools, responsibleshopper.org and greenpages.org, to build this list of leaders and laggards in the athletic shoe industry. Click the links on the company names below to learn more about the conventional companies at Responsible Shopper or to find the green businesses listings in the Green Pages. The Autonomy Project produces sneakers made with Forest Stewardship Council certified all-natural and sustainable latex sole. The company pays fair trade premiums to both the rubber producers in Sri Lanka and to the shoe stitchers in Pakistan. Grade A+. Equita sells sneakers from the Paris-based Veja Company. Veja works directly with Brazilian cooperatives to source eco-friendly organic cotton and natural latex for its sneakers, which are made under fair labor conditions, including living wages and long-term relationships with producers. Grade A+. Global Exchange offers no sweat sneakers in its online fair trade store. Grade A+. No Sweat Apparel produces sneakers at a unionized factory in Indonesia. Wage and benefit information for the workers appears on No Sweat's website, including maternity benefits, Ramadan bonuses, health insurance coverage, and more. Grade A+. Traditions Fair Trade sells sneakers made by Argentinian cooperatives. Traditions website links to The Working World, a nonprofit entity that supports the cooperatives, where shoppers can view a breakdown of where each penny of the purchase price of the shoes is going. Grade A+. New Balance. As a conventional shoe company, New Balance is unique in making more than one quarter of its products in the United States. Its shift toward Chinese manufacturing in recent years has opened the company to criticisms, such as the low wages and long hours documented in a 2006 report by National Labor Committee, NLC, and China Labor Watch, Grade C. Timberland. Timberland utilizes a third-party assessment system for independent monitoring of its manufacturing facilities, but the factories from which Timberland sources have still been cited for unfair overtime, unsanitary conditions, and late pay. Grade C. Nike. Recent factory-level abuses have included the firings of worker organizers at one of Nike's Turkish factories to prevent union activity. Grade F. Reebok Adidas. Recent labor abuses at Reebok's Jordanian factories include human trafficking of guest workers, confiscation of passports, 16-hour shifts, wages below the legal minimum, beatings, and sexual assault. Grade F. Puma. Repeatedly implicated in egregious violations of workers' rights in Turkey, China, El Salvador, Indonesia, and Mexico. Reports from Bangladesh included child workers being beaten, suffering from exhaustion, working mandatory 14-hour days, and paid as little as 6.5 cents an hour. Grade F. If you desired more information on a specific company, you could have gone to another page on that same website. For Nike, you would have learned the following. Nike is the number one shoe company in the world and controls over 1/5 of the athletic shoe market in the United States. Nike discloses its factory locations and employs independent monitors to assess compliance with the company's supplier code of conduct and for purchasing a majority of its energy needs from green sources. However, Nike critics maintain that these efforts do not go far enough to improve conditions for garment workers. There have been accusations of repeated labor violations at Nike supplier plants where employees are underpaid, overworked, and commonly face verbal and even physical abuse. Nike allegedly lied about conditions at overseas factories where their shoes and clothes are manufactured in an attempt to guard the company from criticism for human rights and labor violations. And as a result, the California Supreme Court ruled that Nike can be sued for false advertising after it was found that the company's statements in defense of overseas labor conditions were commercial speech. New tools are evolving all the time to make it easier for consumers to use the marketplace as a polling booth. Even as truth in labeling practices have revolutionized our ability to analyze foods, to know how many calories and how much fat, protein, fiber, sodium, vitamins, and other ingredients they contain, in the near future, we will be better able to determine the social and environmental conditions under which our clothes, appliances, and other products are made. Daniel Goleman discusses social and environmental life cycle analysis, SELCA, barcode labeling, in his new book, Ecological Intelligence, as an approach that is just around the corner. It is a process that will include a barcode on every product that can be read at the point of purchase by a small camera embedded in personal cell phones. All the good and bad aspects of a product will be taken into account, including those at the beginning of its life cycle, such as the mining or farming operations, and those at the end, that is, the costs and benefits of disposal and/or recycling. Such evolving techniques will allow us to hone our skills. Yet we must not wait. Sufficient information is available now for us to make an impact. We cannot expect 100% perfection from ourselves or the corporations, at least not at the beginning, but we can expect a 100% commitment from all of us to strive for perfection. It is our privilege and duty to send out the word that we will patronize only those companies that are dedicated to providing goods and services that embrace the strictest principles of environmental and social responsibility. The process of reaching toward perfection offers limitless opportunities. It opens doors for a new generation of enterprising inventors, entrepreneurs, and business executives. Eliminating the mutant virus allows us to explore new forms of healthy capitalism, to step into an exciting and dynamic economy. That is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 20. Creating a New Economy. The big agribusiness companies use a lot of fertilizers, insecticides, and other chemicals. Nicaragua's Minister of Agriculture and Forestry, Ariel Bulcardo Rojas, said, looking at Stefan Rechtstaufen, "Much of our land has been destroyed." Stefan, an MD by training, had co-founded the Omega Institute in 1977 as an educational center dedicated to personal growth, health, and transformation. He is also author of the book Time Shifting. Now he was building a new holistic learning center in Costa Rica and exploring ways to promote organic farming throughout the region. He had organized this trip to Nicaragua in March 2008 for a small group of philanthropists and social activists who were interested in helping Nicaraguan campesinos. We had traveled to remote locations, talked with farmers, visited local markets, and returned to Managua, where we were meeting with government officials. We kept hearing the same story. Companies like Dole, Chiquita, Cargill, and Kraft had ravaged the land. Policies that were aimed solely at maximizing corporate profits had rendered the soil so infertile that organic farming was now impossible in many parts of the country. The impacts of some of these methods are summarized in a Source Watch article. Chiquita workers in Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Honduras, and elsewhere have accused the company of using toxic agrochemicals, using pesticides outlawed in other countries, including the U.S., in the production of their bananas. In 2002, a Nicaraguan court sentenced Chiquita, Dole, and Dow to pay $489 million in damages to Nicaraguan workers suffering from injuries incurred from contact with the pesticide Nemagon, also known as DBCP, which was banned in the U.S. decades before, after it was proven to cause severe health effects, including vision loss, organ damage, infertility, cancer, birth defects, and miscarriages. It's hard to believe that foreign companies would push chemicals that are illegal in the United States because they are so dangerous off onto another country. Alba Palacios, a member of the Directing Council of Nicaragua's General Assembly, told us. But that's exactly what happened here. Besides farmlands, Nicaragua also is endowed with an abundance of fresh water. Its many rivers and small lakes are complemented by two huge lakes, Lake Nicaragua, with an area of more than 3,000 square miles, the largest lake in Central America, and Lake Managua, approximately 40 miles long and 15 miles wide. Unfortunately, the nation's water is terribly polluted. The U.S. nonprofit Public Citizen reported, "Although water covers 10% of Nicaragua's surface, environmental degradation, pollution, and simple scarcity in some regions threaten the country's ability to provide enough water to sustain its population and productivity. Today, near a third of Nicaraguans do not have access to potable water. In rural areas where 72% of people lack such access, people must often procure their water from shallow wells, rivers, streams, and lakes that are polluted with residential sewage, pesticides, and industrial toxins." Stefan and I stood together on the shore of Lake Managua the day after our meetings with Messrs. Roja and Palacios. The stench was almost unbearable. After the 1972 earthquake, Somoza took all that foreign aid money, Stefan mused, referring to Anastasio Taquita Somoza Debele, who ruled Nicaragua, often brutally, from 1967 to 1979, and whose family had run the country with an iron hand since 1936. He lived like a king. Instead of rebuilding Managua and its water and sewer systems, he siphoned all the human, industrial, and agricultural wastes into this lake. He turned it into a cesspool. "That was during my second year as an EHM. I raised a bandana to my nose as protection against the noxious fumes. I recall that those earthquake funds were earmarked to stimulate an economic miracle along the shoreline. Beautiful homes, parks, a boardwalk, shops, art galleries, perhaps an open-air theater. Tourism and increasing real estate values would allow Nicaragua to pay off its debts and continue to prosper. Instead, this whole shoreline is uninhabitable. What a lost opportunity." I told Stefan about a dinner I attended not long after the earthquake. World Bank President Robert McNamara was the speaker. Afterward, a small group of us who were involved in Latin American projects met with McNamara. He let us know that the bank and the U.S. government, McNamara had been Secretary of Defense under JFK and LBJ, would stand behind Somoza, despite the corruption and human rights abuses, because he was a bastion against communists like Castro and Torrijos. The words had shocked me. I wondered at the time how a man with McNamara's education could denigrate Omar Torrijos as a communist, but I held my tongue and kept my job. Stefan and I then discussed the possibilities of reforming the World Bank. Its original mission was a good one, I said, to reconstruct countries devastated by World War II. Seems like now's the time to bring that mission to places like this. We discussed the idea that the United Nations could work with the World Bank, directing a major campaign to clean up the lake and convert a wasteland next to Nicaragua's capital city into a model for urban planning. Imagine, Stefan said, what could happen if a portion of the United States military budget paid some of the companies that currently manufacture missiles and tanks to instead make equipment that could clean up this lake. It is an intriguing concept, and one that could also be applied to other industries. For example, what might happen if some of our tax dollars paid Dole, Chiquita, Cargill, Kraft, and other agribusinesses to develop ways in which the starving people of the world could feed themselves? Better methods for growing, storing, and distributing food locally. No need to put anyone out of work, just change their jobs. Instead of submarines, pay the creative minds at General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Grumman to make boats that clean up polluted lakes. Instead of banana plantations, hire Chiquita, Dole, and Kraft to develop facilities that refurbish depleted soils and develop food storage systems tailored to poor rural communities. You stroll through Walmart and you realize, Stefan said, that the world is full of junk no one needs. Walk down the aisles of a supermarket and you're struck by the variety of decisions we all have to make. Cornflakes, with or without sugar, or honey. Raisins added or not. Maybe dehydrated strawberries. Brand X or Y. Large yellow box or even larger, family size orange box. Meanwhile, a billion or more people are on the verge of starving. We strolled along a stretch of crumbling concrete where years before someone had begun building a walkway by the water, or something else I could not identify. It now lay in ruins. I kept thinking about how so much of our global economy today is based on junk, items that serve no useful purpose. All the plastics and metals that are wasted, the grains that are processed into foods that offer no nutrition and are wrapped in fancy, wasteful packages, the cell phones, laptop computers, and other electronic gadgets that turn obsolete within months and have as a key component the rare mineral known as coltan that is mined by starving Africans. And I kept visualizing the faces and emaciated bodies of hungry people, the ones I had met in India, Nepal, Indonesia, and Haiti, and the ones I, like everyone else, had seen on TV. I tried not to be depressed, to instead contemplate the possibilities of a new economy based on producing things that people actually need and goods and services that serve the earth and offer hope for the future. I mentioned to Stefan my belief that a revolution is sweeping through the hemisphere. Nicaragua is one of 10 countries in Latin America that have voted in a new wave of presidents, each one democratically elected. These countries, representing more than 80% of the population of South America, in the last few years have elected presidents who sent the world a resounding message. They said no to the colonialist policies that have relegated their people to servitude for centuries. They said no to the predatory form of capitalism that they usually refer to as the Washington Consensus, neocolonialism, or neoliberalism. They demanded the demolition of the walls that had imprisoned them in World Bank and IMF debts. They served notice that they will no longer tolerate the plundering of resources and the privatization of the public sector by multinational corporations. Every one of these countries, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Paraguay, El Salvador, Uruguay, and Venezuela, during much of my lifetime, was ruled by repressive governments and brutal dictators, often with CIA support. These unelected officials had helped the corporatocracy rape their nation's resources. Now, in less than a decade, all that has changed. The people have spoken. Peacefully, in democratic elections, they have voted in presidents who understand that the key to transformation lies in recognizing the value of their resources and their citizens' rights to benefit from those resources, as well as their responsibilities to use them in ways that will help future generations. Significantly, these leaders also comprehend the power of corporations. They know that in order for their people to realize their objectives, they must encourage or force corporations to change their most basic goal. These new Latin American leaders have opened the door to a new economy. In opening that door, they are showing the rest of us a way to combine a form of capitalism that produces things the world truly needs with the goal of making profits while creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. A breeze came up and blew off Lake Managua. The stench from the polluted waters was now unbearable. Stefan and I turned away and headed back to our parked car. Walking across the pockmarked concrete, we lamented the terrible environmental destruction that has occurred in our lifetimes. I kept reflecting as we drove down the streets of Managua toward our hotel on the idea that what we really need to do is move beyond the extreme materialism and militarism that characterize our current economy. It struck me that there were already some pretty good models out there of what the new economy might look like. One of those was high in the Andes. Others were right in our own backyard, in places like Chicago, Denver, San Francisco, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. Chapter 21. Green Markets. Otavalo is a postcard-perfect town perched high in the Ecuadorian Andes. At an altitude of over 8,000 feet, it is located just a few miles north of the equator and is nestled in a valley formed by three volcanoes considered sacred by local populations. It is home to an indigenous tribe that shares its name, traces its origins back to long before the Incas, and is famous for its musicians, weavers, and shamans. Jorge Tamayo was one of those shamans, and also my compadre, the father of my godson. We strolled together through the market one Sunday morning. The thin Andean air smelled of wood smoke. The melancholic music of panpipes, flutes, and drums, played by a local band, competed for our attention with the shouts of weavers hawking sweaters, shawls, ponchos, and tapestries that hung from their stalls and from lines strung between them in such a brilliant profusion of color that we could have been passing through a rainbow. "Wool from our own sheep and llamas," Jorge explained. "Everything made in the homes of our families." He stopped to chat with an old woman. Her clothes were the traditional straight dark blue skirt that reached to sandals woven from the fibers of the agave plant, a white blouse with red and green embroidered flowers, and a necklace of gold beads wrapped several times around her throat. "Did you make this yourself, grandmother?" he asked, picking up a red-trimmed blue poncho and offering it for my inspection. Her creased face broke into a smile that flashed gold teeth. "My daughter did," she said proudly. "These days my eyes aren't so good. I do most of the selling. My children and grandchildren tend the animals and are the weavers." It was the poncho I had been searching for as a gift for a friend. Jorge bargained with the lady, I bought it, and we walked on. "I often think of this market," he said, "when I go to your country." He had a U.S. visa, and he traveled to New England, where his talents as a shaman and his knowledge of Andean traditions were in demand. "Everyone there talks about the environment and tells me not to buy certain products because they're made by people who are mistreated." He stopped and looked about. "Here, we don't have to worry about that." I told him I felt the same. Since my first visit to Otavalo's market in 1969, I had been impressed with both the quality of the work and the fact it was all done by local people using local materials. In recent years, though, things had begun to change. Now some stalls sold items imported from Peru and even Asia. At the same time, however, change was coming to my country. It seemed that the pendulum had begun to swing in the other direction. "On your next visit to the States," I said, "I'll take you to markets that are similar to this one, not in the products they sell or the way they look, but philosophically. I was thinking of the green festivals held each year in Chicago, Denver, San Francisco, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. A joint project of Global Exchange and Green America, the green festivals feature more than 350 eco-friendly businesses, everything from organic body care lotions, tennis shoes, and clothes, to fair trade foods and home and garden products made from renewable resources. All green festival exhibitors are screened for their commitment to sustainable business practices. More than 25,000 people typically walk through the marketplace in any given city. Besides the stalls, there are other activities, including speeches by business leaders, authors, and educators, workshops, films, activities for children, organic beer, wine, and cuisine, and live music. One of the speakers at a recent festival was Tom Hartman, author of The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, What Would Jefferson Do?, Threshold, and more than a dozen other books, and host of an Air America radio show. During his talk, he pointed out something that particularly struck me, and also is stated in Threshold. At a certain level, our modern consumer society is built on a truth and a lie. The truth is that if you're living below the threshold of safety and security, a little bit of stuff can create a huge change in your mental and emotional states and the quality of your life. The lie is the siren song of our culture. If that much stuff will generate that much instant happiness, the lie goes, then 10 times as much stuff will make you 10 times happier. It seemed a fitting observation in the context of those two types of markets, the first located in one of the hemisphere's poorest countries, and the second in affluent, highly materialistic U.S. cities. When I finish giving my speech at a green festival, I am hustled off to the bookstore within the marketplace. I sit there at a long table with several other authors and sign books. It is a wonderful opportunity to chat with people. They ask questions and sometimes pour their hearts out to me. Their words often reflect those of Tom Hartman. We must learn, they say, that we in the States can live on much less, and yet there are people all over this globe who need so much more. The starving, desperate people have to receive a fairer share. Afterward, I wander through the marketplace. As I examine the foods, clothes, shoes, and appliances, I am always impressed by the ingenuity of our people. There can be no doubt that the green festivals and other fairs and markets across the land are creating a new economy. We are on the verge of crafting a global marketplace with far-reaching implications. I am also reminded that we the people did this. People like Denise Hamler, Elisa Gravitz, and Paul Freundlich, who started Green America, formerly Co-op America. Kevin Danaher, Medea Benjamin, and Kirsten Moeller, who founded Global Exchange. And the thousands of men and women who are organizing green markets in towns and cities across the globe. A new type of thinking and inventiveness is infiltrating the world. It is apparent in the trees planted along Shanghai's highways and in China's commitment to replacing gas-guzzling cars with electric ones. It is apparent in the Port of Los Angeles' purchase of electric trucks capable of pulling 60,000-pound shipping containers that were developed by the innovative Balcon Corporation. It is apparent in the Grameen Shakti Corporation's drive to turn Bangladesh into the world's first solar-driven economy, and in the array of goods TerraCycle produces, from cookie and candy wrappers, potato chip bags, drink pouches, and other wastes. It is apparent in the fancy purses and shoes made by Jade Planet from discarded plastic bags, and in so many other goods and services that are entering our economy at accelerating rates. A student from the University of Washington recently reminded me that when the car was popularized, the streets of our cities were inundated in horse manure, and the farmers around those cities were struggling desperately to keep up with the daunting task of feeding the horses. The automobile was hailed as our savior from pollution and food shortages, he said. No solution is forever. Another student confessed that she would have to work for several years at some big corporation in order to pay off her student loans. But then she added with a glowing smile, "I'm going to build a company that will profit from cleaning up the floating island of garbage I sailed through in the Pacific Ocean 2 years ago." In the last months, I have heard voices like those expressing similar thoughts in Ecuador, Iceland, Panama, and China, and across the United States. Last year, I heard them in a number of other countries. They are the voices of our future, spoken by the people who are navigating our economy away from predatory capitalism into a vibrant new form. The new economy will divert monies from manufacturing weapons to creating goods and services that bring harmony to our planet. It will transfer capital from developing chemical fertilizers, insecticides, and genetically modified organisms, GMOs, to implementing systems that facilitate local organic farming techniques and empower starving people to feed themselves. It will reward companies that clean up the lakes of Nicaragua, replant the devastated forests of Borneo, and develop new technologies for harnessing renewable energy. It will remove needless items from our shelves, the trinkets and gadgets that serve no purpose except to make a few rich CEOs richer, and replace them with things that enhance life. This new economy will transport us from the adolescent attitudes that encourage us to exploit others into the mature recognition that we are one community living on a fragile planet. It will result in a more efficient distribution of goods and services, and at the same time obliterate the terrible suffering that is at the root of most of this world's violence. The people driving this new economy are today's entrepreneurs. They will prosper. They are the good stewards who will be tomorrow's heroes.